Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
So if you can't hear now, you really have problems with your hearing. can we put this over on this side like that? There. That's good. So we're going to read from Bhagavad Gita chapter 9, text 23. This verse is quite interesting because it presents a dramatic contrast with other historical religious traditions in terms of it's a different kind of monotheism. So we'll discuss that. And of course at the end the good guys win, Hare Krishnas. So, the Sanskrit for this verse is Jepyanya Devata Bhakta Yajantesha Dhyanvita Te Pimam Eva Konteya Yajantya Vidhipurvakam. Prabhupada's translation, those devoted to other gods who worship them with faith actually worship only me, O son of Kunti, but they do so in a wrong way. Prabhupada's purport, persons engaged in worship of demigods are not very intelligent, though such worship is offered to me indirectly, Krishna says. For example, when a man pours water on the leaves and branches of a tree without pouring water on the root, he does so without sufficient knowledge or without observing the regulative principles. I guess the regulative principles for watering trees. Similarly, the process of rendering service to different parts of the body is to supply food to the stomach. Demigods are, so to speak, different officers and directors in the Supreme Lord's government. One must follow the government laws, the laws made by the government, not the laws made by officers or directors. Similarly, everyone is to offer his worship to the Supreme Lord only. That will automatically satisfy the Lord's different officers and directors who are engaged as government representatives. To offer some bribe to the officers and directors is illegal. This is stated here as avidhi purvakam. In other words, Krishna does not approve the unnecessary worship of the demigods. So, there is a common mistake, common misunderstanding in the Western world, and actually even in the Middle East, that monotheistic traditions, traditions that accept one supreme god, exist, you could say, almost exclusively, according to this false conception, in the what are called the Abrahamic religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. You know, all three, of course, the Jewish tradition is based on what they called the Bible, the Old Testament, and then Christians accepted the Old Testament but added their New Testament, and Islam accepted the Old and New Testament and then added what they felt somehow was the culmination of this revelation in the form of their Quran. So all three groups accept the Old Testament. Interestingly, you find a sort of a parallel phenomenon in India, in the sense that all the different groups, you could say within Hinduism or whatever, accepted the Vedas. And then at a certain point in history, which is described in the Bhagavatam, in the Kali Yuga, people couldn't understand the original Vedas, so other literatures came forward, like Puranas and Itihasa, Mahabharata, Ramayana, and so on. And the Ashtadasha Mahapurana, the 18 great Puranas. And then, of course, then we have a third level, which is, you could say, for example, our Gaudiya Vaishnava literature, literature coming from Lord Chaitanya and his followers. So you can trace various historical levels in the development of sacred literature. Oh, that's not going to help.
I mean, if you want.
Oh, no, I'll put it here. Okay. Yeah, because I don't want to put it below me. Because I'll get in trouble with Krishna. So, in any case, going back to these religions that came out of the Middle East, a part of the world which still is ferociously tribal and sectarian, they have this idea. They have this idea that monotheism really comes from that region. You know, the story of Abraham breaking his father's little idols and deciding there's only one supreme God. And anyway, the point I want to make here is that we find in the Bhagavad Gita a very powerful monotheism. It's not something which is, you could say, indirect or subtle. It's a very powerful, very strong, explicit monotheism. There's one supreme God. And Krishna makes this point again and again in the Bhagavad Gita. So, and yet, even though there's one supreme God, it is not a jealous God, so to speak. And Krishna, at a certain point in history, in certain parts of the world, you could say certain kinds of monotheism became quite toxic. They became sort of poisoned by a type of murderous sectarianism. And of course we know the history of wars and so on. And a certain type of fanatical and really ignorant language arose, such as, you know, this is the living God and you worship a dead God, or this is a true religion and you have a false religion. And this language itself is, of course, quite crude and ignorant, especially the way it was applied, because it was applied in a very crude and ignorant way. And here, Krishna is giving a different picture. Krishna here says that if you worship the demigods, well, he specifically says, jepyanya devata bhakta, those devoted to other gods, devatas, deities, those devoted to other deities, jepyanya devata bhakta, yajante shadhyanvita, those who worship, and they're devoted to other deities and they worship with faith, tepi mam eva kunti, they're actually worshiping me. We don't have this sort of this spooky devil idea here that, you know, you're just worshiping the devil. You're in Missouri, so you must have heard some of this. So, this is actually a much more enlightened view. And without going into too much, there's evidence, according to scholars, according to prominent scholars of the Old Testament, the Old Testament gives a picture in which there are, in fact, a plurality of gods, but there's one supreme God. In other words, it's closer to the Vedic conception. In fact, in the very beginning of the Ten Commandments, it said, you shall have no other gods before me. It doesn't say no other gods exist. It simply says, you shall have no other gods before me. And in fact, we do find in the Old Testament lists of gods with the caveat that the Jewish people, the Hebrew people, should worship Yahweh, or the supreme God, and not the demigods, which is basically what Krishna is teaching here. So, I mean, in general, the tendency toward monotheism is a sign of rational thought. For example, if you study, the idea that there's just, the idea of polytheism is not philosophical at all. And if you look at the various polytheisms of the world, I mean, anywhere, India, China, or Greece, or Rome, or Scandinavia, or, you know, anywhere in the world, if you look...
Sorry.
Not you?
Sorry. Is that a phone or a baby toy? Whatever it is, you know.
It's I guess some of our members bring their own toys. So the idea is that polytheism, it's not philosophical at all, because there's no serious interest to know where does everything come from. In fact, if you look at the various polytheistic traditions of the world, generally the so-called ruling God is not the origin of everything anyway. It's just a particular powerful celestial figure that manifests at a certain time. And so you see, say, in ancient Greece, that there was a philosophical revolt against polytheism. You see this very clearly in the philosophy of Plato, Plato's Republic, that there was actually a rejection, a repudiation of the notion that the highest truth is polytheistic. Krishna also rejects it. Because just to say that, okay, for example, it's raining, it's thundering, there's lightning, there's some god behind that. Or there's a sun and there's some god behind it. That's not philosophy, it's a type of pious recognition of divine power here and there in nature. But just as in physics, when you try to understand what is ultimately the, like Newton, for example, who could explain so many things through the law of gravity, when you come to the point where you're trying to understand what is the one principle that explains everything, that's the tendency of rational thought, to categorize, to synthesize, and ultimately to distill in the best case, a single principle which explains everything. And so behind monotheism is in fact a desire to understand the one behind the many. Now, Prabhupada makes a distinction in the beginning of his introduction to the Srimad Bhagavatam between the notion of absolute truth and the notion of God. There's a type of unphilosophical monotheism. There's a type of unphilosophical monotheism in which the claim is simply made that one God is the highest, but there's not a clear understanding of the relationship between God and everything else. It's just, basically, there's one supreme God, he has an anger management problem, and he's also jealous, it's a jealousy issue. And if you don't worship that one God, something very bad will happen to you. Or the Son of God, something even worse will happen to you. So those types of monotheism are almost tribal in a sense. It's just like our God can beat up your God. Whereas, so I actually like to make a point about this to understand what Krishna is really saying here. And that is that I think the difference between, what do you need?
I got a little table on here.
Table? Well, I'm fine, unless you need a table. This one's serve some drinks. So, the difference between philosophical and non-philosophical monotheism, and frankly, as exemplified, I would say, by the monotheism of Bhagavad Gita and Vedic culture, in contrast to certain kinds of monotheism that came from the Middle East, I think this contrast can be seen very clearly in the hostility of Middle Eastern traditions toward deity worship. The hostility of these traditions toward deity worship, which is really exposes the irrationality of those traditions that oppose deity worship. And so I want to explain that. In other words, it's not as they imagine that somehow when one becomes more advanced, one gives up this type of idol worship or whatever. But actually, I would say that in Middle Eastern traditions, they tend not to accept deity worship because they are pre-philosophical and pre-rational in their monotheism. So I want to explain that point. If one objects to, let's say, God or the idea or the claim, if one objects to the claim that God is present in what is apparently a material object, like there, you know, a physical deity made of some type of metal or wood or stone, marble, whatever. What's going on? Anyway, it's already a Christian temple. So, if one objects, if one says that God cannot appear, God cannot appear in such forms, then that is an ontological claim. It is a particular branch of philosophy which is called ontology. Ontology is the branch of philosophy that deals with the nature of existence. What exists, what are the real things that exist, how do they exist, and so on. The nature of existence is called ontology. So, what's that for? Oh no, it was fine. The Gita was actually very happy. No, this, I appreciate all the efforts, but anyway, so this is a very important point. The basic claim of those who are hostile toward deity worship is that God is the most holy and pure, and somehow matter, material energy, is somehow impure and unholy, and therefore it's very offensive to juxtapose, to bring together the holy and the profane, that which is pure and that which is hopelessly impure, namely matter. So that's the basic thing. That's the basic objection. And we find one remarkably bad argument given against deity worship in the New Testament by a gentleman named Paul of Tarsus, as in St. Paul, where he traveled, basically his mission took him around the Roman world, which means around the Mediterranean, where everybody was engaged in deity worship, usually almost always demigod worship. And so first of all, he associated with this deity worship with polytheism, which is not the case with Vaishnavas. And secondly, he gave a bad argument, which I'll repeat here, although it's the infallible word of God according to some people, but actually it's a bad argument. He said that he challenged the people who were making offerings to the gods, saying that if your God is actually God, why do you have to feed your God? Why do you have to, you know, give clothes to your God if this is actually God? My reply to Paul would be, if you are serving the real God, why do you have to speak for him? If God can feed himself, he can also speak for himself. So he doesn't need you to travel around and speak for him. Because a God that can feed himself can also speak for himself. The obvious point is that God is giving us a service. Anyway, getting back to ontology, if you are simply more or less a religious fanatic, or not very philosophical, then you'll simply say matter is impure, matter is evil, or matter in the material world is profane. But if you are capable of philosophy, then you ask the question, what is matter? What is matter? That's a philosophical, even a scientific question. And also, from a philosophical perspective, you have to immediately make a distinction between appearance and reality. To take everything exactly as it appears to our senses and mind is... Well, it's not very thoughtful, is it? So as soon as you begin to ask questions like, well, what is matter, ultimately? For example, we know through physics that objects that appear to be solid may not be simply solid. It may actually be a type of energy field. And so there are many different ways in which appearances can be deceiving. And we have to ask the further question, you could say a theological or philosophical question, If there is a God, what is the relationship between God and matter? Now, in India, if we look at the Vedanta tradition, that was the sort of the intellectual heavyweight division. The Vedanta tradition, if you look at all the great Vedantists, such as, well, Adi Shankara, Ramanuja, Madhvacharya, and others as well, then all their different positions are ontological positions, specifically on this issue. They, if you take the tattvas, the Sanskrit word tattva means a fundamental truth, a fundamental real thing. Prabhupada sometimes simply translates it as truth. The word tat in Sanskrit. Tat, if you just add an H, it's English, that. So tat is the simple demonstrative pronoun, neuter demonstrative pronoun in Sanskrit. So tat, the way it was taken by great thinkers in ancient India, is that because tat is a demonstrative pronoun, it demonstrates, and like you say, that. Therefore, taken literally, or simply, refers to a real thing. And so therefore, in philosophical shorthand, the word tat came to mean a real thing. And ultimately, everything, the reality of everything, depends upon one real thing, which is God. And therefore, the ultimate tat, or the ultimate real thing which can be demonstrated, is God. So you have expressions like Om Tat Sat. And that's sort of what's behind it, that the idea that tat refers to a fundamental real thing. And especially when you add the suffix tvam, tat tvam. Because tat tvam, tvam in that case is a suffix, means having the condition of being that, or in other words, having the status of a real thing. And therefore, because it means that specific word was used to indicate fundamental real things, as in jiva tattva, or Vishnu tattva, or Prakriti tattva. So, if you look at the different Vedanta positions, they distinguish themselves by how they understood or interpreted the relationship between these tattvas, namely Ishvara, Prakriti, and jiva. In fact, when we glorify Prabhupada as Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschati Desarni, Vishesha in Sanskrit means a distinction. Like, for example, the word Visheshana means an adjective. That's how you say adjective in Sanskrit. Because an adjective is something which distinguishes one noun from another. Like the old man, the young man, the tall man, the short man. So adjectives perform this function of distinguishing. So nirvishesha means one who preaches that there are no distinctions. In other words, jiva and Ishwara or Vishnu are the same. Vishnu tattva, jiva tattva. So that's the nirvishesha, which means the claim that there are no distinctions between real things. There's only. In any case, then Ramanuja, of course, so Shankara was simply Advaitavad, which means that there's no distinction. And then Ramanuja, of course, is Vishishta Advaita. Again, the same word, Vishesha, Vishishta. In other words, there is an Advaita, there is a non-duality, but it is distinguished by different parts. There's Ishwara and Jiva, there's God and the soul, and so on. In any case, what's interesting, and then of course Madhva was famous as a dualist, Dvaitavad and so on. But what's interesting is that you do find statements in the Vedas, the Upanishads, such as Sarvam Kalvidam Brahma, that all of this, meaning the whole universe, all of this is Brahma, is the Absolute. And Krishna refers to all the same thing, the power of apparently material things to take on the Absolute nature. Krishna talks about this in chapter 4, where he says, Brahma Arpanam. You know the word arpanam, an offering. So Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 4, that Brahma Arpanam, that when you make an offering to the Absolute, Brahma Arpanam, Brahma Haviya, the Havis, which in Sanskrit means ghee, and here it just symbolizes whatever happens to be offered, that the offering, Brahma Arpanam, Brahma Haviya, the offering takes on the same Absolute nature. Brahmagno, it's offered into the Brahmagni, into the fire of the Absolute, and the person who offers Brahmanahutam also has the same Absolute nature. And Brahmaivatena Gantavyav. So, this ultimate, Lord Chaitanya ultimately explained all this very simply by saying Bheda Bheda Tattva. Bheda Bheda Tattva. That the relationship between God and ourselves is that we are one and we are different at the same time. And a simple example which is given by the Vaishnavacharyas, it's also given by ancient Western philosophers, is that of the sun and the sunshine. If you ask the simple question, is the sun one thing or is it many things? For example, in astronomy, we learn about the sun's surface, the sun's core, the sun's spots, the sun rays, etc., etc., etc. And so, when you study the sun from the point of view of science, I mean, you talk about many, many components of the sun. So you could say the sun is many things, or you could simply say it's one thing, it's just the sun shining. And so it really is one and different, the relationship between the sun and the sun rays and so on. So getting back to deity worship, what is matter? It's not merely, first of all, it's not evil because it comes from God and God does not create evil. So matter is not evil. It is simply Krishna's energy or God's energy. And so, if Krishna chooses to appear, as Prabhupada always used to say, within his own energy, what's the problem? I mean, certainly it's not that people in India never figured out that in one sense Krishna is appearing in matter, because, for example, in one of the most famous temples in India, the temple at Puri, Jagannath Puri, every so many years they give the deity what is called Navakalevram, new body. So those who are actually worshiping the deity, they understand, for example, that a deity made of wood, as in Puri, that the wood gradually deteriorates and you have to get a new piece of wood. So it's not that people didn't notice this. But still, Krishna can manifest within, and you find the same thing even in the Bible, for example, for God's sake. I mean, you find in the Old Testament that God appeared to Moses in the form of a burning bush, a bush that was burning but didn't consume itself. So these are called epiphanies, or God somehow manifesting himself in some apparently secondary manifestation. So, again, if you understand the ultimate oneness, that although there is variety, there are different tattvas, there is jiva, or the individual soul, there is Vishnu or God, there is prakriti or matter, and it's like the sun. These are different components of reality, and they are eternally different components of reality, and yet it's all one. Krishna himself says that Haribo, maybe you can do flower ball a little later. Yeah, thank you. Sorry. It's your duty to be bored right now. So, Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, Bahunam Janmanam Ante Gyanavan Mam Prapadyate. After many births, one who has knowledge surrenders to me, knowing Vasudeva Sarvam. Vasudeva is everything, Krishna is everything. And Arjuna actually explains this in chapter 11, where he says, Sarvam Samapnoshi. You encompass everything, Atosi Sarvam. Therefore, you are everything. Because you encompass everything. So, this power of God, that he encompasses everything, that he is everything, although everything is... I mean, after all, we not only see Krishna in the deity, this is just practicing. Krishna ultimately says in the Gita that Jomam Pashyati Sarvatra, one who sees me everywhere. Jomai Sarvam Pashyati, one who sees everything in me. That's the real yogi. That's the real yogi. So the simple idea that matter is somehow evil or bad, or that God cannot appear in his own creation, it's not a very philosophical point. And so we understand perfectly well that God is not a material object. I mean, that's very clear to us. We also understand that all material objects are his energy. So, not only material objects are Krishna's energy, but the empowered jivas, the empowered souls who are managing the creation as a service to God. So you can actually see this, you could say this deterioration of so-called monotheism, where it starts out as there are various gods, but you should worship the supreme God, and it finally comes to the somewhat degraded mentality that no other gods exist, no other beings exist, and this sort of jealous, violent, practically envious hostility toward many elevated beings. So anyway, Krishna consciousness, we are, as I've been saying in some of my classes, in a sense, Prabhupada's coming and our attempting to carry on his mission is really the culmination of the Renaissance. Because if you look at the history of the world, the word Renaissance, of course, in French means rebirth, Renaissance. And it was a rebirth of what? That word Renaissance was given by the people themselves, the Renaissance. It's not a word that later historians gave to them. That's the word they chose for themselves. And actually, it's a rebirth of Indo-European culture. It's a rebirth of Indo-European culture. If you look at... It's very interesting. If you study, for example, Roman religion, the original Roman religion, it's basically Western Hinduism, down to little details. So, I mean, just as Latin and Greek are intimately connected to Sanskrit, so in the same way, if you look at the religious traditions of these people, it's very similar to Hinduism. So, and not really talking about their religions, but their cultural achievements in general. So after the Dark Ages, after the Middle Ages, when people started to revive or rediscover this Indo-European culture, that's what it is, Indo-European culture, they called it the Renaissance. And a period in time when this Indo-European culture had been forgotten or lost, the people themselves back then, the thinkers, gave the name Dark Ages. And that's basically what it was. So, Prabhupada's coming is a continuing rediscovery of the original Indo-European culture. And actually, it is Indo-European culture. They're actually, I mean, scholars agree on this, and there's evidence in the Shastras even, that originally there was an Indo-European civilization. I mean, just a few points of evidence that is that something I find kind of amusing, that according to the Bhagavatam, something most devotees haven't noticed, is that according to the Bhagavatam, 10th canto, Narada Muni is blonde. Narada Muni is actually, according to the Bhagavatam, is blonde. Another flaming blonde, is, according to the Rig Veda, is Indra. He has hair the color of gold and sunshine, so that's called blonde. Anyway, it's interesting that, so it actually was an Indo-European civilization. And Prabhupada says as much. And that is the only reasonable explanation that anyone has found for the fact that the Sanskrit language is so intimately connected to practically every European language, with the exception of Basque, and no one knows where in the world that came from. You know, and the language is brought by the Huns, as in Attila, when they invaded Europe. Anyway, so Krishna here is saying that when you worship demigods, you are worshiping me because they emanate from me. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, in chapter 10, Name vidu suragana prabhavam namaharshya. Neither the hosts of gods nor the great sages know my origin. Aham adhir hi devanam, because I am the origin of the gods. Krishna says that, Aham adhir hi devanam. I am the origin of the gods. Maharshi Nang Sasarvasha, end of the great sages in all respects. So the demigods, they come from Krishna. They're, Krishna empowers them. Krishna creates them as demigods. And so if you worship them, Krishna says, you're really worshiping me, but your worship is avidhi purvakam. Vidhi, you know, means rule, a rule or injunction, and avidhi. And purva, the Sanskrit word purva, which is probably related to the English word, English words like first and former, and so on. It means, that's what it means, first or former. Purva. So, purva ka in Sanskrit is a suffix which means to make something, to prioritize something, to make something foremost. And so it comes to mean predominated by or characterized by something. And so Krishna says that the worship of other gods is avidhi purvakam. It is characterized by irregularity. Because, and as Prabhupada very nicely and very clearly explains in the purport, because we're not worshipping the actual authority, but rather worshipping someone who is merely assisting the actual authority. It's like if a policeman stops you and you want to offer him money, you know, of course if you're in Mexico, then that's probably a very good idea. Or, I don't know, I won't mention some parts of the United States. Anyway, but let's say in a place where things more or less go according to the rules, then you have to give the money to the court, not to the police officer. Anyway, any questions on these points? We've covered a range of topics here. Yes?
I had a question about one Sanskrit word, water. I've noticed there's three different names for water in the Bhagavad Gita. Like in chapter 7, text 4, water is referred to as apa. 9:26, water is referred to as toyam. It's 11:39, it's referred to as varana.
As what?
What
verse is that? Varana?
It's 11:39 in the Bhagavad Gita.
Anyway, you certainly are quite studious. Varuna. Oh yeah, he's the god of water. I mean, it doesn't really mean water, but it means the god of water. But the god of water can mean water. Like sometimes, for example, I mean, we do that in America. Like we say that, let's say, the United States and Russia entered into an agreement. It doesn't mean that, you know, these land masses talk to each other, and it means the people representing the places. So in the same way, Varuna is the person. Why are there different words?
Could you say Patrum Pushpam Phalam
Pa? Toyam.
Yeah.
You could, but the meter wouldn't work.
Okay.
Yeah, Sanskrit, the Vedic culture was intellectually, literarily, very, very sophisticated. Vedic culture was, or the people in ancient India were literally thousands of years ahead of the rest of the world in the study of language. And they like to use words. And, like for example, in Arabic there are dozens of words for camel. But in Sanskrit there are many words for lotus. So those things which were very prominent, I mean, we actually have different words for things even in English, for certain things. But it's just a rich language. And it was a culture that was very much inspired by nature. If you read the Mahabharata or Srimad Bhagavatam or Ramayana, you find the sages who are telling these stories go into long descriptions of flora. Like they'll talk about it. I mean, the sages definitely would choose to set up their ashrams in very beautiful places. They appreciated the same things we do now, like a beautiful river, a clear lake, a waterfall. They're really into waterfalls. They love flowering trees, fruit trees. So it's clear that the sages were really, in a sense, nature lovers. And they have their many words because of their appreciation for nature. There are many words for these natural things. And it's an old culture. It's a culture which existed for a long time. And that was achieved a very, very sophisticated level in terms of literature and philosophy. And people, and it was a culture that really people took great pleasure in the artistic and creative use of language. Yes, what can we do for you? Actually, I say it a lot. Why do we say it?
Why do they not say it, like, oh my God?
Why don't they? They do say, oh my God.
Some people, they say it's bad to say, oh my God.
Oh, because there's a statement in the Bible, I think, that you shouldn't take the Lord's name in vain. So they may think it's like trivializing God's name. But when I say, oh my God, I really mean, oh my God. So, I guess their fear is that you'll forget that you're really talking about God. Like, for example, when you say, let's say, Minneapolis, St. Paul. I mean, who thinks of St. Paul as a religious figure? It's just a city next to Minneapolis. Or if you say San Francisco, who's thinking of St. Francis of Assisi? Or if you say Los Angeles, who's thinking of angels? Just thinking of smog and movie stars. So that's the idea. Sometimes when you take a name that should be sacred, like God, and just use it all the time, it's like, you know, it's almost like you reduce the value of it. You're sort of trivializing it. Therefore, if you say, oh my God, you should really mean it. Oh.
And for a school project, and I came across one statement that said Prabhupada was killed or something by his disciples. So how do you take that?
Oh, how I take that is lunacy. It's there is a certain minority group of people in the world who are kind of unhinged, and you know, they see a conspiracy everywhere, and they're not very scientific or rational. So, yeah, again, a very small group of people came with an idea that at the end of his life, some of Prabhupada's disciples had poisoned him or something, based on a statement he made. And then it turns out, on examination, Prabhupada wasn't even speaking English when he made this statement. I mean, it's very silly. It's actually very silly. And Prabhupada's passing away at a certain point can be scientifically explained based on pre-existing conditions that were very well known. And so, you know, on the web, you go on the web and find all kinds of crazy things. Because in any society, a certain percentage of the people are nuts. And, you know, hopefully it's a minority or a small percentage, but, and they put all kinds of crazy things on the web. I had the experience myself. There were some people who were criticizing me, last year or so, and it's funny because you go on the web and read it, you don't realize that some of the main critics actually have been diagnosed medically with serious psychological problems and are actually under heavy psychiatric treatment. And so you won't know that. You just go on the web and read something. And that's the nature, that's sort of the downside of freedom of speech. But what can we do? You know, we have to accept it. So, how old are you?
Nine.
Very bright girl. Reminds me of myself when I was nine. I wasn't a bright girl when I was nine. Same gender I am now, but very good. What's your name?
Trinity.
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 Yeah. Oh, like Trinity. That's from the Matrix. Sriniti is Suniti. That was Niti means, yeah, morality or justice or wisdom. Krishna says the word niti in the very last verse of the Gita. No, not Krishna, but Sanjaya, in the very last verse of the Gita. Yatra Yogeshwara Krishna, wherever there is Yogeshwara Krishna, the Lord of mystic power. Yatra Partha, Dhanurdhara, and the bow-wielding Partha. Tatra Sir Vijayo Bhutir, there will be opulence, victory, and power. Dhruva Niti, and especially Niti. Matirama. So that's the last verse of the Gita. Something else?
Maharaj, talking about matter not being some separate evil alien thing.
Not absolutely separate.
Knowing that it's part and parcel of Krishna, he even says so, it's my divine energy. Can you discuss a little bit about the downside of people's experience, such as pain and torment? Is it their misconception of that energy? Or is you know, because people ask, is God punishing? You know, why would God even have pain? You know, other than the reason of, it's an impetus for you to drop your attention on this temporary nature.
Well, we had a long discussion of this in Kansas, that Bhaktivan, that community south of Lawrence, Kansas. And yeah, we had a lot of nice, intelligent guests. They really went at it, because and they were, some of them were disturbed by the idea that, you know, these, like in, let's say, World War II at Nazi concentration camps or tsunamis or whatever, that somehow these people could deserve it. Somehow people are very attached to the idea of innocent victims. It's, and people, of course, many people aspire themselves to become innocent victims. So why does God give us pain? Okay. We'll take a minute and do this at no extra cost to the congregation. The issue here is, the question really is God a perfect moral agent? A moral agent in philosophy means someone who is conscious enough to be responsible for what they do. Like a little baby, let's say a little baby kills another baby, you can't really prosecute the baby, it's just a baby, or someone who's retarded or whatever, or legally insane. So to be a moral agent, one has to be sufficiently conscious to be responsible for one's actions. That's a moral agent. So certainly God is conscious. Therefore the question is he a perfect moral agent? There's a technical word for this in Western philosophy from the Greek. It's called theodicy, from theos, which means God, and dike in Greek means justice. So theodicy means, is there justice in God? Does God act fairly? It's like your little kid. Sometimes little kids think that their parents aren't fair, like, you know, why didn't I get to do that, or why do I have to do that, or you didn't make my brother or sister do this or that. Have you ever had a thought like that? Oh. Imagine if you did. Okay. So, anyway, anyone here have any brothers or sisters? So you know what I'm talking about, right? So that's the issue. Or it's also called the problem of evil. I mean, and the problem is very simple. Philosophically speaking, if there is a triple O God, which means omniscient, he knows everything, omnipotent, all-powerful, and omnibenevolent, all-good. If there's a God who is all-good, all-knowing, and all-powerful, then he knows that people are suffering, and being all-good, he wants people to stop suffering, and being all-powerful, he can stop their suffering, so why doesn't he do it? And so what we practically see is the suffering doesn't stop, so therefore there... This is the argument. It's ultimately not a valid argument, but the argument is, therefore there cannot be a God who is all good, all powerful, and all knowing. There was even an attempt, there was one rabbi that wrote a book, sort of a really bad book, Why Bad Things Happen to Good People. And his answer was, because God is not a triple O deity. He's not all powerful. God really is merciful, and he knows we're suffering, but he just you know, doesn't have the power to do anything about it. So, so this rabbi abandoned, you could say, a strong concept of God to try to explain our suffering. I think the basic problem is, because we had a long discussion of this over there by Lawrence, and I think the basic problem is that people are so trapped in the bodily concept of life that when they see a baby suffering, you can tell them, you know, that's not really a baby, that's actually an eternal soul that has a background and previous lives. Okay, I understand that, but why is the baby suffering? So it's, people are so absorbed in the bodily concept of life that, they just can't think otherwise. Another point is, but if God is a moral agent, take the example of a dentist. I know you love to go to the dentist, right? And get your teeth drilled and everything. No, you don't. Okay. So let's say someone goes to the dentist, and the dentist informs you that because of a condition in your mouth, you have to undergo a procedure. Now, you expect the dentist, on moral grounds, to address your problem in the least painful way possible, right? With the least discomfort possible. So, I mean, that's a general definition. If God is really perfectly good, if God is perfectly good, then He must only cause us pain when it is necessary. It's the minimum pain necessary to bring about an essential good. So you think about that simple definition. The minimum pain necessary to bring about an essential good. I mean, what do parents do? If parents have to punish their child or take their children for medical treatment, the rule is to cause the child the minimum pain necessary to bring about an essential good. Isn't it? I mean, that's basically it. It should be the minimum pain necessary, and the good should be essential and not just optional or frivolous. So, is that the case? Is that the kind of God we have? A God that causes the minimum pain necessary to bring about essential good? And, yeah, we do. So, if you say, well, God could bring about the same good and not cause us pain, it seems to me that ignores practical psychology. For example, how do you protect someone's free will? We have free will. You cannot, and so Krishna respects our free will. He honors our free will. So how do you, and yet we do sometimes, well, here's another point, actually, to understand all this, you have to understand, and that is that I always bring this up, brought it a million times, but since I'm not always in St. Louis, you haven't heard it a million times, so I'll say it anyway. People listen to my lectures as on the recordings, you know, sorry, you got to hear it again. There's this great line in Euthyphro. There's a Platonic dialogue, a dialogue written by Plato called Euthyphro, in which the speaker is Socrates, Plato's guru. And so Socrates raises this fascinating question. He says, are some actions good, morally good, because the gods love them? Or do the gods love those actions because they are good? In other words, let's say, if you look at Bhagavad Gita, what you find is that certain actions are considered to be good, not because Krishna just happens to like them, but because they're intrinsically good. There's a Buddhist argument against the Vedic idea of reincarnation, which is a false argument. They say that the Buddhist concept of karma and reincarnation is superior to the Vedic concept, because the Buddhist concept of karma, it's not a question of some god or goddess imposing their whims on us. It's just the fair, objective, reasonable reaction to what we've done. Like a type of moral physics, action and reaction. But again, going back to this question raised by Socrates, are certain actions good because the gods love them? Or do the gods love those actions because they are themselves good? And it's the second. If you read Bhagavad Gita, when Krishna talks about rewards and punishments in the Gita, it has nothing to do with dogma or doctrine. It has nothing to do with believing a particular religion. It has to do with the moral quality of your behavior. So one thing people don't notice, because we're used to fanatical religions, but in the Bhagavad Gita, you can be elevated. You can be elevated, you can be wise, even Krishna says enlightened, and you can be happy in this world without Krishna. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, Urdvam gacchanti sattvasta, those standing in goodness, sattvasta, go upward. Urdvam gacchanti. And Krishna says, tasmat sattva nirmalatvat, because goodness is relatively free of gross impurity, prakashakam, the mode of goodness is enlightening. Prakashakam, ananamayam, not grossly contaminated. And Krishna says, from goodness comes happiness. And yet, after saying all that, Krishna says in chapter, was it the Modes of Nature, chapter 14, yajante sattvika devan, those in the mode of goodness worship, in the mode of goodness worship the demigods. So Krishna says, those in the mode of goodness go upward, they have wisdom, they have material happiness, and yet they worship the demigods. So this is not a jealous God. Krishna is not this crazy, you know, well, I mean, there's no jealous God, actually. It's just a false concept. So if you don't worship Krishna, what happens to you? Actually, Arjuna directly asked that question. Arjuna says, if people give up Shastra, they don't follow Shastra, what happens to them? Arjuna asked that question at the end of, actually, the beginning of chapter 17, because chapter 16, Divine and Demoniac Natures, Krishna concludes by saying, Tasmat Shastram Pramanante. Therefore, Shastra is evidence for you. Shastra is your evidence. Literally, that's what Krishna says. Tasmat Shastram Pramanante Karya Karya Vyavastito. In situations of what should be done and what shouldn't be done, Shastra is your evidence. That's what Krishna says. Gyatva Shastra Vidhanotam, knowing therefore what has been ordained in Shastra, Karma Kartumi Harasi, you should perform your duty. So Arjuna has a question. Arjuna says, Jay Shastra Vidhimutsridya, those who reject the rule of Shastra. Those who reject the rule of Shastra. Jay Shastra Vidhimutsridya, Yajante Shadhyamita, and they worship with faith. They're performing some kind of worship, they have faith, but they reject the rule of Shastra. Teshaṁ niṣṭhā tukā Krishna satyamā rajastamā. What is their situation? What is their status? In a sense. Teshaṁ niṣṭhā. What is their status? Is it goodness, passion, or ignorance? There's no question they didn't go to hell because they didn't accept Krishna. And then Krishna says, Sri Bhagavan Uvacha, Trividhā bhavati śraddhā. It's interesting because Krishna starts talking about faith. In other words, these people don't have faith in Shastra, but they have faith in something. Because in Arjuna's question, he said they have faith. And because of this faith, they worship or offer sacrifice, but they don't accept Shastra, the scriptures. So Krishna says that there are three kinds of faith according to one's nature. And, you know, goodness, passion, and ignorance. And then Krishna says, Satanu rupa sarvasya shraddha bhavati bharata. Faith arises in everyone according to their nature, according to their existence. And the living being is constituted of faith, and whatever faith you have, you become that thing. But what's interesting here is that, and then he says, yajante sattika devan. Those in goodness worship gods. So, if you reject Shastra, what happens to you? It just depends on the quality of your activities. It's not like there's an angry God, okay, dude, you rejected Shastra, you know, you're going to burn forever. It's not like that. Krishna just says, if you don't accept Shastra, you don't accept what I'm saying, then you'll just get whatever result is appropriate based on the quality of your actions. So it's completely rational. And therefore, but if you think of this, therefore, if someone is suffering, it's not because God chose to punish that person. It's because that person is simply receiving the natural, appropriate, corresponding experience based on what they did. It's like if you smoke cigarettes and you develop lung cancer, you can't curse God. There are many young people in this country that demonstrate their high intelligence by smoking cigarettes and putting their baseball hats on backwards to make sure that their faces are not protected from skin cancer. So wearing your baseball cap backwards is definitely a sign of higher intelligence. Anyway, so the suffering is actually, the root of the suffering is not the will of God. The root of the suffering is the quality of your own behavior. And Krishna is objectively, reasonably, simply allowing the appropriate laws of nature to act. So that's the first thing that... and another point is, despite all the great suffering in the world, Krishna is a loving father and mother. He says, Pitaham asya jagato, I'm the father of this world, mata, and the mother, by the way. Krishna also says, I'm the mother. He will never, a loving parent will never injure their child. You know, you may give your child a little discomfort as punishment, but you'll never injure your child. You don't break your children's bones. And so that's what Krishna actually does. He puts this virtual reality machine over us called the material body, and then we experience the body. The soul is never injured. Krishna is our parent. He never injures anyone. No one ever dies. He's just putting you through all these virtual reality experiences so you'll develop proper consciousness. And even then, the experiences we have their root in our own behavior, not in the will of God. It's not Krishna's will that we suffer. A few points there. So, maybe we'll end here. Leave everybody smiling. So, I guess we'll have classes. When's the next class?
Tomorrow night, we've been invited to Lal Gopal Prabhu's house. Same time. Different place.
Different station.
Jagannath, Baladev, Subhadra are there.
Oh.
It's a very nice setting for the congregation to come together.
So, hasta mañana. See you tomorrow. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.